All right, now it's recording. All right, today is May 6, 2015. This is a follow-up interview with Michael Rosen. We are here in Milwaukee at Local 212 of the AFT. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Mass Oral History Program. Michael, to make sure I get the sound quality as good as I can you say your name and spell your last name?
Michael Rosen, and the last name is spelled R-O-S-E-N.
Thank you. So, Michael, we did our interview last year, almost a year ago, actually, over the phone. About the Black Strike. Since I have this opportunity to do a follow-up interview with you, there's some other things about your time on campus I would like to ask.
That's great.
So what I want to start off with is that first year, that freshman year, I don't think I asked you exactly where you ended up staying that first year. I think we got it for a couple other years.
But my first year I stayed at Ogg Hall, which has now been blown up and rebuilt. I went to some kind of anti-war meeting. That was my first political involvement, was going to some kind of anti-war meeting. And it was run by a group called the Socialist Workers Party. And it turned out to be their meeting where they were electing leadership. And they asked me if I wanted to be treasurer or secretary. I don't remember. And I thought that was very strange. Because I'd never been to a meeting before, and to put someone in a position of responsibility like that didn't strike me as reasonable. I never went back to that group, and I got arrested for the possession of marijuana that year. So I didn't get involved in politics at all because I felt, and this is probably some level of youthful self-absorption, that I would discredit whatever political movement there was because I had been arrested for marijuana, and they could, they could use that against me.
Right.
So I got arrested on, is it State Street, University Avenue, coming home with some pot in my pocket and late at night on my way back to Ogg Hall. So I wasn't politically active at all for that reason.
Okay. I already asked this, but it might be slightly different for that first year. I assume that some places you would hang out in your first year, like to get a bite to eat or something, would be residence hall dining. Is that?
I was a member of the residence hall. I forgot what it was called, but it was whatever was associated with Ogg Hall. Mm-hmm. But I also, people hung out at the Ratskeller and the Student Union, and there was no Student Union South. There was only the Ratskeller, and also occasionally at the Brat House, which no longer exists in a different reiteration now. Mm-hmm. Iteration. It's I don't know exactly what it's called, but and there was a McDonald's as well that was pretty close to the campus. So that, sometimes go there for lunch. Those are the things that I recall. They didn't have all these food wagons the way they do now, or anything like that on the mall.
Mm-hmm. And you may have mentioned this in the first.
There was a. In the student union, there was kind of a cafeteria, not the Ratskeller part, but when you first walked in, if you kept going kind of straight, there was a cafeteria in the back, and people ate in there a lot for breakfast or lunch.
Okay. I think I asked you this last time. I did, but I want to clarify. So coming in as a freshman, 18-year-olds were allowed to drink, but it was at the
3.2 beer. Okay. Yeah.
And so was that being served on campus and on State Street?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was served at the Ratskeller. I don't think it was served in the dining hall. Not that I remember, but it was absolutely served on at the Ratskeller. And
then places like the Broad House, as you mentioned. Okay. Yeah. You mentioned in the first interview that you were You drove to campus, first time you've been to campus, and you were impressed with Camp Randall.
Yeah.
I'm wondering in general, though, you know, did you attend athletic events on campus?
I was a big-time soccer player in high school. And when I first got to campus, before I got arrested for marijuana, before I started that kind of partying activity, I actually went, they did not have a, they had a club soccer team. And it was played somewhere in the southern part of the campus. And I went to the practice, and it was almost all foreign students, and almost all, they were African, primarily, and Latin American. And they were either upperclassmen or graduate students. And I was intimidated. I didn't feel very welcomed, and I never went back. You know, I had, you know, when I was in high school, I was I broke my school scoring record my senior year for goals in a single season. And, at one point was talked to by Dartmouth about coming there to go to play, but I didn't want to stay in New Hampshire. And I just dropped it. I didn't get back into soccer until my son, who's now 40, was 7, and he started playing again. And then I resumed playing here, and there's a pretty sophisticated men's league, and which is all, initially was always also based among immigrants. And I actually played with the Verdi, which was the Italian club. In any case, I was interested in sports, but I'd been a Wisconsin sports fan. I earned 12 letters in high school, baseball, ice hockey, and soccer. Once I got to Madison, and other than that, attending the, you know, going to the soccer thing and not feeling particularly welcome, I got into other things, mainly alternative, you know, hanging out and so forth. And I think the only football game I went to was my senior year when I was about to leave. You know, it was the last year I was going to be there. And UW was horrible the years I was there. I think they went 2 years without winning a game. I mean, I followed it, but I didn't go to the games. And then my senior year, Bob Greasy, the father, not the son, Purdue was playing Wisconsin. And I went to a November game just because I wanted to see Greasy play. And I think that's the only, I've been to many more games since I've left the university than I ever attended while I was there.
You sort of answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. And maybe it's more about when you got more involved in politics, so maybe not so much your first year, but the subsequent years. What sort of things would you do? I guess the question is, I'm assuming you'd get together and talk, you know, on occasion politics or whatever, but I'm wondering if you just sort of socialized for the socializing sake, and if you did, what sort of things you did?
There was kind of a alternative or left-wing kind of movement. There was something called the Green Lantern co-op. And when I was a junior, I met my wife, who was a freshman, my wife-to-be, who was a freshman there. We subsequently got divorced many years later, but I'm trying to remember the freshman year, you know, there was kind of a progressive, generally a progressive movement with people had parties, you know, they were politically radical. They listened to folk music like Bob Dylan and Rolling Stones. But I wasn't, you know, and there, I think I remember going to a couple protest rallies against the war. I mean, the one I remember the most was, and I believe this was either my freshman or sophomore year. It was probably my freshman year. There was a guy named, a graduate student named Bob Cohen, Robert Cohen. He and another guy, Evan Stark, were pretty prominent kind of student left-wing leaders. And I remember going to this rally, which was small, on the library mall steps, and Cohen telling people, well, you're a socialist, you might not even know it, but I'm telling you, you're a socialist. And, you know, that I don't know why that stuck with me, but it did. I think they were involved in 67 in Dow boycott, in the Dow activity, and I'm not sure if they were expelled or not, but in any case, I don't know, that's kind of a meandering and not very specific, so I don't know, maybe.
So, I mean, so it sounds like, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like, you know, during this time period, even socializing, you were socializing with people who were like-minded in terms of their politics.
That's right. Okay. That's absolutely right. I mean, most of the students that I was associated with were against the war. They were concerned about civil rights and the black freedom struggle. And I mean, I would say, you know, particularly in the, at least in the liberal arts school, that was pretty pervasive. And, you know, you had professors like, which we talked about last time, like Mossy, Goldberg, you know, in sociology, Zeitlin, Maurice Zeitlin was there. And even though he didn't encourage activism the way someone like Goldberg did, you know, he was definitely on left political spectrum. And I think I mentioned to you Professor Haupt, Haupt. I think I had him my sophomore year. He was a French Holocaust survivor, and as I recall, a Marxist, because I remember learning about class and Marxist terminology in his class. I think it was French social history. I'm not sure, but you know, he made an impression on me. He had numbers on his wrist, mm-hmm. and that might have been my junior year. I'm not sure, but you know, in any case, if you were in the liberal arts school and if you were studying history and sociology and, you know, those kind of subjects, the students you were running into in general were progressive and sympathetic to both the opposition to the war and to the civil rights struggle.
Mm-hmm. What was, not that there was any such thing probably as a typical class session, but I've been told and I've heard that, you know, students were, I wouldn't say confrontational, but maybe that's the word, in class. It just seems today, the classes, I, you know, even when I was a student in the 80s in classes today, it seems there are people who ask questions, but it's sort of a passive, they'll let the faculty talk at them. And I'm wondering,
I don't remember it being confrontational, but I remember it being, the classes I specifically remember, and I talked to you about, was Mossy, because I ended up in his honors section. And that was a great experience. And Goldberg's, in general, weren't confrontational because he'd get up and he was almost like an actor on a stage in front of 400 people, you know, and he would just start gesticulating and, you know, talking, and it was like a show. Another class that I remember my freshman year is I took a philosophy class, and I remember the professor laid out all of the things that we said about communism, that they that they invade other countries, that they don't allow free speech, that they I forget the various you know, that the police mistreat people, and saying these are all things that we do in this country, and it really that really struck a chord with me. It made a lot of sense to me. I don't remember all of the litany of things that he talked about, but I remember that. I specifically remember that conversation. And you know, it's interesting what you remember. You know, right. I mean, that's one, and the Bob Cohen thing is another.
Right. So this next question might help us transition.
But I don't remember people. I don't remember people being confrontational in my classes. I do know that during my period of time there, that at a certain, I mean, we were able to take courses like Physics for Poets or Black African American or Black Music, which were, you know, kind of alternative types courses, and that was something that we chose to take. And I even remember that I was somehow allowed to organize a independent study class that other people could take in my senior year. And you know, I don't remember what it was on. It was Revolutionary Social Theory or something like that. I could look at my transcript and it would be on there.
Right.
I assume I have my transcript somewhere. So there were those kind of options. So I had to take a science, and that was never my strong suit. So I took Physics for Poets, and I don't remember exactly why I took the Black music. I mean, it was taught by a prominent jazz musician whose name escapes me at the moment, and it was. As I remember it, it was a fairly far out class. I mean,
and this question might help us segue into anything else you might want to say about the Black strike. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if you recall or if you were involved in, because I've also heard in that time period that students who weren't in a class would try to come in and either interrupt a class.
Oh, I see.
So
yeah, well, during the strikes. When the strikes were on, whether it was during Dow or the Black student strike, absolutely. When you were on strike, and the campus was being struck, we would go into classes, and I'm sure I did this because I kind of have vague recollections of it, although I'm not positive I did it. I don't know if I ever did it in a class I wasn't a member of, but I know that when Dow happened. I got up in a class and said, look, people are being beaten up. You know, the police are kind of running rampant on campus, and there's a strike. We've got to join it. And that would happen during those strikes. One of the things that was always interesting, I mean, in retrospect to me, is that it was always in the spring, there was this big uprising. Mm-hmm. And in the later years, when I was like a conscious political organizer, we always had small groups of people who were like doing dorm organizing, trying to educate the dorm students and get them involved and part of the movement. And then all of a sudden something would happen, like the invasion of Cambodia or the Black student strike that would kick off, and you know, and then generally there would often be a police reaction. Mm-hmm. The Dow thing, I think one of the things that contributed to Dow was that you had a police department that was probably not trained to deal with civil unrest, and so it was turned into a free for all. But it was it was kind of like in the spring, every spring there'd be a major uprising, except for the year of Dow, because the leadership of the movement got expelled. People like Bobby Simon was one of the, he was like a junior and a protege of Harvey Goldberg. And I heard that he ended up being a rabbi. I don't know that that's true, but I heard that. But a lot of the, that was in October, and a number of students got kicked out, and who are the leadership of that. And so there wasn't that kind of uprising in the spring. But in the spring of 68, when was the Black Student Strike?
69. Mm-hmm.
In the spring of 68, King got killed.
Right.
And there was a huge march. It was not necessarily civil disobedient, but it was a huge march. In the spring of 69, you had the Black Student Strike, and in the spring of 70, you had the TAA strike in Cambodia, I think, as well, the invasion of Cambodia. And I don't know if Kent State was that year. Or
Kent State was May 4th, 1970, so it was that
year,
too.
Yeah, so Kent State, and also there was a school in South Carolina in where African-American students got shot. So, you know, it was kind of like we'd be doing this organizing day-to-day, painful political education is really more what we'd be doing. And then something would kick off, and you'd end up with this huge social movement with people taking to the streets. And I don't want to belittle the movement at all, because I think it was important, but I often thought it was almost like, instead of having panty raids, you know, that you read about in the 50s in the spring, you'd have these, you know, this youthful energy, and because it was so politicized, that youthful energy was directed, I guess, so I don't delegitimize it, positively into progressive political action, especially if you had people who were kind of establishing some political authority during the year, which is what we were trying to do, so we could give leadership to it. And there were other people doing that as well, through the student government, and the student government and the anti-war movement people worked pretty closely together. Margie Tabankin, I remember, who later became a leader of VISTA. She was one of the heads of the student government. Tom Schneider was the vice president of student government. He's here in Milwaukee and heads the Children's Outing Association. And this is kind of aside, but years later, I was in Milwaukee in like the late 70s working as a reporter for the Milwaukee Courier, which is a Black newspaper. And this was when one of the police officers who in 1958 or 59 had shot Ernest Lacey, and I mean, it was ruled a justifiable homicide. Lacey was found with a knife. Was it not Ernest Lacey? Ernest Lacey was a police movement in the 80s, but there was I can't even think of the guy's name now.
Okay. But in the late 50s.
In the late 50s, there was a young Black man killed by the police in Milwaukee. Two police officers who was involved in that, and it was ruled a justifiable homicide. They found a knife and went away. By the late 70s, one of the police officers who was involved in that, Daniel Bell, that was the name, the kid's name, Daniel Bell. One of the police officers had become an alcoholic, and as part of his recovery, he had to tell the truth, his 12-step recovery. So he came forward and admitted that they shot the guy and that they planted a knife on him. And so I was a reporter for the Milwaukee Courier. And when the verdict came down, I forget, it was the verdict. I mean, they tried the officers, and I forget exactly. They got some kind of punishment, but it wasn't first-degree murder, and they didn't get long prison sentences. So people in the community were upset, and my job as a reporter was to interview, you know, write an article on it. And so I wrote I interviewed different community leaders. And then I called Tom Schneider, because he was the assistant DA who had prosecuted the police officers. And the first thing he said to me was, "Are you Mike Rosen?" I didn't realize or even associate his name with anybody I knew. He's the assistant DA, and he prosecuted the case. And then he goes, "Are you Mike Rosen from Madison?" So I was kind of taken aback. And so I go, "Well, I'm a Mike Rosen that did go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison." So I was trying, you know, I'm in my reporter position. And he goes, "Don't you remember me, Tom Schneider? I was the vice president of the Student Association. We used to run the leaflets off for you guys against the war." And so Tom and I subsequently reacquainted, but in that capacity, it was interesting because Tom's perspective was that for the first time, a Milwaukee police officer was successfully prosecuted for police brutality and against someone in the black community. And of course, and I remember him being very dismayed when me telling him that, well, people in the community think that the guy got slapped on the wrist. But that was Tom Schneider. And he ultimately became the assistant DA, and then there was some scandal, and I don't remember exactly what it was, and he left and became, or he was accused of some things. He was never prosecuted for them, but he left, and he became the head of something called the Children's Outing Association, which he heads to this day. And he was one of the early supporters of Obama in 2007, in Milwaukee, one of the early people who jumped on the Obama campaign. Anyway, I don't know if that's here or there, but it's all interesting history, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So another thing I want to ask about that time period, you mentioned in the first interview and then just mentioned in this interview the fact that, in your opinion, the Madison police had little or no training to prepare them for what happened in Dow.
Right.
I'm curious that in your eyes, is there a difference between the Madison police or Wisconsin police reaction to the protests as they went along and then the National Guard when the National Guard was on campus?
Well, the National Guard, as I recall, the National Guard would kind of come into campus and kind of just stand there, you know, and guard the buildings. Whereas at Dow, the police actually waded in chased people, grabbed people, beat people. People were trying to take their clubs away from them. I mean, I remember it as a real melee. Whereas the National Guard more, I think, would, whether they were at the Capitol or they would come in and be standing and kind of physically a presence. And I don't remember that kind of, I don't remember any kind of actual fighting between them, which I do remember at Dow between the people and the police.
Okay.
But I remember, you know, there's a book by David Menares.
Right, The War at Home?
No, there's that. That's the
film.
Oh,
yeah, sorry. They Marched into Sunlight.
They Marched into Sunlight. And there was actually, I never read the book. I bought it. But there is a public television made a movie on it. And I watched that movie. And it was really interesting to me because they interviewed a number of the police officers who were from the east side of, white guys from the east side of Madison who were Vietnam vets. And, you know, they articulated a level of hostility towards demonstrators like myself, who they perceived as upper class or, you know, privileged kids who had gone to war, and I didn't go to war. This is something I don't think I told you, but I guess I might as well now. Years later, maybe in 1990 or 1990, no, maybe in the early 90s, I had been teaching here since 1987, and I'd gotten active in the union. And I was, I went and spoke to the technical and industrial division. The dean at the time was a guy named John Stilp. He's since retired. And John and I developed a relationship, you know, a collegial relationship based on being committed to promoting manufacturing careers and in general manufacturing. And so I spoke to the division, and a couple days later, Stilp called me, and he goes, can you come down to my office? I want to talk to you about something. So I stopped down, and he said, listen, Mark Bogans, B-O-G-A-N-S, Mark Bogans came into my office, and Mark Bogans was a police science instructor. And he, and Bogans came into my office and said to Stilp, do you know Rosen, who spoke to our division? He was a SDS leader in Madison. And Stilp says, okay. And Bogans says, because I was assigned to tail him. Huh. And so dial up, I get elected president of the union in 2000. And Bogans is still working here. So now I knew this. I didn't see any advantage in raising it. But I always thought I'd like to just at some point sit down, not to be confrontational, but, Bogans was always towards, he's since retired. He retired about a year ago. And when all the Walker stuff happened, he would come up to me, and he had the longest hair of guys of my generation, you know, at the school. And he'd always come up to me, Mike, I'm trying to deal with these coppers and make them understand what Walker's doing. And, you know, he was like in line with, mm-hmm. you know, our fighting for our union. And he would always thank me for what the union did and the work that we did. And, you know, he was a big supporter. And so, again, there was no reason to, the relationship that we had, even though I knew about this, there was no reason to bring it up. But when I saw I was retiring, I figured I want to talk to the guy about it just to see what he thought about what he did and what his perspective was. I just thought it would be interesting. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to do it before he retired because I didn't want to impair the current relationship that we had. So I called him up and just said, hey, I need a half hour of your time. And I didn't tell him what it was, and he never called me back. Mm. So I never was able to have that conversation. And I'd still like to do it. Just, you know, it's kind of like bring closure to something. Or,
right.
So it's kind of an interesting. But I think that's kind of interesting that they say the past is never leaves you or mm-hmm. something. So.
There's something else I was going to ask, but I want to make sure if there's anything else. You know, the first time, we talked about
the black student strike. But I think I told you that I had gone to Willie Edwards and others, Libby, and I don't remember the other leaders, when San Francisco State happened, and said we need to do something here, and you have it in the notes that they had said we can't do anything because. Until we get ourselves together, it's kind of a general rap among a lot of black activists. We have to get ourselves together before we get, before we try to organize anybody else. And then, you know, I think you called it the Black Revolution Symposium. It's mentioned in here. Mm-hmm. That happened in February. Now, I didn't know about all this stuff going on in December, in February, Nathan Hare came. At least this is what I was told, because Edwards called me up and he asked me to come to a meeting. And I don't know if I told you about the meeting or not. So I go to a meeting, and as I recall, they used to have hotel rooms in the student union of some small hotel rooms to rent, it might have been there, or it might have been in a hotel somewhere, but it was a hotel room. And I was the only white person at the meeting. And that's where they told me, listen, and they invited me there to get the white students to back the strike. And one of the people there, not Edwards though, said, kind of, at least in my view as a 20-year-old relatively naive person, that we're going on strike, you know, on Monday or whenever we are, and if this leaks out, we know who is the leak, and basically said, we'll take care of you. So, you know, my job was to go get the white students ready, allegedly, go get the white students ready, but it was, you know, at that time, it seemed pretty ominous, you know. Anyway, I mean, I remember that. So, and that meeting was how I mean, they called me, I think, because, well, they called me for two reasons. One, I had a relationship with Edwards, who had also at one point dated my cousin. My cousin was a freshman when we were all freshmen, and Edwards dated her briefly. But also, since I had gone to him and said, look, we have to do something, and he knew I was active in kind of political circles, I guess they figured they could come to me to get, you know, as their conduit into, you know, I don't want to call it the white left, but the anti-war activist student groupings. And the only other thing I think I noticed in here, you talked about at the end, there was this thing where people destroyed some property and so forth. And I think, you know, the people who proposed that thought that it was a way to jumpstart the strike again. I think a lot of people who participated in it, I mean, if you look at it objectively, it's like when a movement is coming to its end, there's a certain level, without necessarily success, there's a certain level of frustration, and people strike out. You know, I mean, you could say the same thing about kind of like the weathermen, when the, you know, maybe different motivation, but, you know, they strike out. And I think other people participated in it because they felt like they had to be part of, you know, they couldn't give in if other people were continuing to fight. But it was clearly, you know, in hindsight, which is 2020, but it was clearly, you know, an act of frustration on behalf of the hardcore activists because the strike had run its course.
Okay.
Now, also in retrospect, the strike was successful in the sense that it got the university to establish a black student center. Later, that was morphed into a multicultural center of some type. And I don't know if they, did they set up a black studies department? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were already a lot of African-American oriented courses. Like I had a course with a guy named Starobin on African-American history. I had a couple courses. Starobin committed suicide. His father was a prominent member of the Communist Party in the 30s and 40s. And the guy was really a brilliant teacher, and clearly had depression issues and committed suicide I'm pretty sure it was while I was in college. But there were a number of courses, like I told you, I took black music or I had African American history, and I think I took African American literature too. So there were a number of courses already, and so I think they put them together into a studies program. And that was there were some real victories out of that. I mean, the thing was, I mean, when you look back at it, and today, even when you think about the problems at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the thing is that there was so few black students on campus. Like in the black student strike, a number of the athletes were active. Football players, you know, not so much basketball players because they probably were too busy with basketball. But there were a number of football players who were active in that strike. And that's because to be a black student at Madison at that time was fairly isolating. In fact, I have a colleague here who was a black student in Madison in the early 70s and graduated from there, but did her graduate work at Marquette because she felt it was so isolating. Mm. And I think that was the experience. I mean, if you want to put the context of why there was a black student strike, there were a handful of black students other than the athletes on campus. And, you know, it was a predominantly white campus. And at that time, people came to Madison from all over the state. It wasn't just, you know, today, I think Madison has a lot more students coming from places, just like large numbers coming from Brookfield and Mequon, at least when my stepson went there in the late 80s and early 90s. That was what his perception. He went to Rufus King High School here, but mm-hmm. his perception was most of the kids are from these kind of bedroom suburbs now, whereas mm-hmm. when I went, there were kids from all over the state. You know, it was really but that meant lots of kids without any contact with students of color. And I think it was pretty isolating for students of color.
I have a couple more things about this time period. So you came here, or you came to UW
mm-hmm.
from New Hampshire.
Yeah.
I hear a lot. I'm not from here. I didn't go to UW, but yeah. I hear a lot about coasties, relationships towards people who came to Madison from yeah. the coast. I'm wondering if that was ever an issue for you when you were there.
Well, it cut both ways for me, because the kids from New York, you know, I mean, yeah, was it? I never felt like a coastie, if that's the term they use. Because I was from New Hampshire, and the kids, there were a huge number of progressive kids from New York and the East Coast, and they were very articulate, very aggressive, very sophisticated in my eyes growing up in New Hampshire. But one of the things I always resented is they were like, oh yeah, I went to camp in New Hampshire. Well, that's where I grew up. You know, it wasn't like a camp. It wasn't a summer camp. And I didn't go to summer camp. You know, I started working when I was in eighth grade. I mean, working, you know, summer jobs when I was in eighth grade. I mean, I'm not trying to say I was poor, because I wasn't. It was middle class, but... it was a different, so I never, on the other hand, lots of my friends, well, I had friends from Milwaukee, people, one of the guys, I met him in 68, Bruce Colburn, he's the head of SEIU here now, and that's kind of, anyway, his father's sister, unbeknownst to either of us when we met, was the woman who stood up at my parents' wedding when my father was shipping off to World War II. So I mean, maybe the Jewish community was fairly small in Madison at the time my parents went there. I don't know. Mm. But, you know, I had several friends who were in the movement from the Milwaukee area. One of them works here, Frank Shansky. Went to Marshall High School, and he works for our union. And then there were people, one of my roommates, my sophomore junior year was a guy named Jeff Schachner. I'm still in touch with him a little bit. I mean, I hadn't been in touch with him for 30 years, but we've gotten reacquainted. But I, in any case, I would say the left wing, the progressive movement was heavily influenced by people from New York, New Jersey area, and disproportionately Jewish. But I never felt discriminated or, and as I said, I had an ambivalent relationship to that group in the sense that they thought my hometown was a summer camp, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
So at least one more thing I want to ask about this time period is something you just, you talked about briefly in your first interview, and you just alluded to it or talked about it a couple times, and that's being Jewish.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, you know, being Jewish on the Madison campus in the 60s, if you felt that influenced how you were treated or...
I mean, I come from a secular Jewish family, and I grew up in a town that was overwhelmingly white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, to the point where when I was 12 or 13, I had to stand up at a bris for a professor's kid because there were no adults. There weren't 13 Jewish men in the town. And I didn't, you know, we didn't do seders, we didn't go to synagogue, we didn't. On the other hand, I had two aunts who were Holocaust survivors, and so I was well aware I was Jewish, but it didn't mean that, you know, it was more my immigrant history than anything else. And I didn't feel, I guess in retrospect, I can look at a lot of the leaders who were there and people who were active, and they were Jewish and progressive, you know, left-wing people. But I didn't, I probably have a stronger, since I've gotten older, I've kind of, and more recently I went and visited some relatives in Denmark, so I've kind of gotten more interested in that aspect of my own history. But it wasn't particularly, I mean, I think that what I heard was that back in the day when my father went to Madison, one of the reasons was that the Ivy League had quotas on Jews who could, the number of Jews who could go into Ivy League schools. So a lot of them came to Madison because it was such a good school. And again, you know, my father had professors, commoners, and what's his name? There was a Jewish labor economist at Madison in the 40s, the 30s and 40s. I have some of the papers he graded of my father, who was very progressive and helped establish kind of the post-World War II social contract. So I think that there was always a presence of, in a certain way, a disproportionate presence of Jewish progressive people in Madison. I mean, that's kind of how this guy Colburn, who became my friend, the head of the SEIU here, his aunt and her husband stood up at my parents' wedding. I had no idea until like the 1970s when we were talking about something, and he said, "Oh, that's my uncle." And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And I'll certainly say when I was in Madison, a number of the Bob Cohen, you know, Billy Simon, I mean, these were, and I think, you know, a lot of them had been active in political movements in New York, and they brought that experience with them. And they were all big talkers. They were all very assertive.
So, Michael, I don't think I asked you this last time. We did talk about how you transitioned sort of early on from going to Madison to being involved in the labor movement. But I want to ask if you've reflected upon how your time in Madison, those years, influenced who you became.
Yeah. I learned how to organize in Madison. And I learned how to organize, you know, I mean, different things that you got to put a face on the enemy, how you move people, have to listen to people and find issues that matter to people and organize them around those issues, and the value of social movements and how you build social movements, you know, how you engage, involve people. I learned all that in my formative years organizing in Madison. I maybe couldn't have articulated it, but I know that that I learned all that at the University of Wisconsin, not in the classroom, but in the social movements that I participated in. I learned a lot of my analysis of the world in the classroom from Mossi and Goldberg and Haupt and Zeitlund and others. You know, the black African-American history course I took with Starobin. So my outlook on the world was definitely shaped by those classes and the readings I did and just being in that environment, which was a tremendously stimulating intellectual environment, you know, challenging kind of the idea that America's one great big melting pot and consensus theory, and got introduced to Marxist theory there. And other ideas. So both in terms of a framework for thinking about the world, and how to function as a political person who is committed to kind of social movement organizing, I learned both of those things in Madison. I learned how to do both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Some, the one in the classroom and the other in just the general environment. It was an incredibly stimulating, exciting environment to be part of.
And it sounds like you made friendships or built relationships that have ended up lasting through the test.
Absolutely. I mentioned Bruce Colburn, he's the head of SEIU here. We've been friends since 1968. When I say that we've remained friends, we've remained friends. There have times when he didn't live in Milwaukee all this time. I've been here since 70, but, you know, just a few years ago, he spent 3 or 4 years in Washington, D.C., working for SEIU, heading up their fight for the Affordable Health Care Plan. Maybe that was, you know, whenever that was. And at another point, he had gone to Pittsburgh and worked in steel mills and whatever. But, I mean, we remained friends and are good friends to this day. I mean, I was just at his house Saturday night to watch the fight. Frank I met down there, and Frank actually helped me get hired here because he asked me to come in. He was teaching a class here and said, would I come in and talk about community organizing, which I had done some here. And I spoke in his class, and then maybe a semester later, he said, would you like to teach part-time here? And I'm like, sure, I enjoyed the class. So I came and applied and got hired. And by then I had gotten a master's degree. I'd gone back to school. It was a casual relation, you know. I mean, he helped me get hired here in the sense of encouraging me, but it wasn't like we were well in touch. But then when I got elected president, he was the staff person at the union here. And so for the last 15 years, which I've been president here, we've had a very close relationship. But it goes all the way back to Madison. So with their great success in basketball, we've gone to a fair number of games. He went to the Final Four this year, and I was going to go, but I had family things. But so yeah, there's a number of people, and then what happened is that my daughter, this is probably not of much interest, but my daughter is a graduate student at UCLA, my youngest daughter, and so when I was going out to visit her for the first time, she's just finishing right now, getting her PhD, but when I went out to visit her, I connected with one of the guys who I'd known in Madison. And he got in touch with a bunch of ex-Madison people who were out there, and people I hadn't seen since 1970. And I've been out there now 2 or 3, 4 times maybe, and we get together every time, renew those relationships. They were all people who are involved in the movement. Shackner's one of them. Henry Shipper, is another. I don't know if you've interviewed him. He's an interesting guy. He came from Eau Claire. His mother was a Holocaust survivor, and he's an independent filmmaker in L.A., a little bit younger than I am. And then there's a guy named Ken Mate, who was very kind of active in Madison. Kenny Mate. So they all, and David Roloff, who was, they were, anyway, they all live out in that area. Mm-hmm. So I stay in touch, you know, we email each other. With email, it's right. Easy to stay in touch. So.
Right.
And there's a guy, Billy Drew, who was my roommate my junior year, and I'm in touch with him. Yeah, and John Melroy. There's a number of people, I mean, who I've remained in touch with, and who are all politically active. And Drew just worked on the Chuy Garcia campaign. Melrod is an attorney who is doing a lot of work around police murders in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then another guy who I'm not really that much in touch with and wasn't good friends with, but I certainly know of from my era, is Peter Neuenfeld, who did all the Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. He's one of the two founders of that. So, and he was real active in our group at Madison as well. Okay. So,
Michael, is there anything else you want to say about your time?
No, we probably should move because I have a 3:00 meeting. So
yeah. So this concludes this interview with Michael Rosen. Thank you very much.